This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rania Khalaf, the Chief AI Officer of WSO2. We're going to talk about WSO2's AI strategy that has just started to unfold at WSO2Con here in Barcelona. Rania, hello.
Hi, Ian. My name is Rania Khalaf. I recently joined WSO2 as Chief AI Officer. My background has been in cloud and AI for a couple of decades now, starting in IBM Research in the early days of service-oriented computing. I did a lot of work on the foundational standards and early implementations of web services. Then I was heading up a group in IBM Research that did work on the cloud. Some of the things we did were Istio, IBM's serverless capabilities, and so on. And then I was very focused on AI, building Watson's deep learning training backend that was cloud native. The last few years, I've been working in a biotech startup, looking at how can we use AI for gene editing. Finally, I'm back at WSO2 to the core of component-oriented computing and how do we build systems for today's applications.
The outline we saw in the main keynote was that AI was going to be used on both sides of the organization. It was going to enable us to build APIs, but at the same time, it was going to be one of your primary tools for managing APIs, looking at what we need to do, understanding governance, and a whole bunch of things like that. But there wasn't a clear product roadmap as to where you were looking to go. Is there anything you can give us as a heads up to start with?
Sure. We don't see AI as a separate product on its own that we do separately from the core capabilities we have around helping you build awesome, intelligent digital experiences. For us, we see AI as a new enabler, as a new tool or technology that we want to infuse into everything that we do and that we offer to make it faster, better, easier to use, as well as for our customers to be able to infuse AI into the applications that they build. Mm-hmm. If you think about the keynote, we see that if you go to every product, they're making announcements of AI capabilities embedded within them, like faster login flows, branding, governance from natural language interfaces. Wherever we see that there is a way to use this new technology to make our user experience more delightful, we are going for it. We are also using it to say we believe that the new application, the modern application, is going to be AI native. Mm-hmm. These technologies are great. It's like many years ago when we started having APIs show up and service-oriented computing and so on, we saw that the way we write code changed, and now we don't really think very much about an application that doesn't call an API. Mm-hmm. We went from calling libraries and functions to just saying, okay, we assume it's networked, we assume it can call things that live and are managed outside. Mm-hmm. We see that same thing for AI. These are new capabilities that make an application potentially better, smarter, more knowledgeable, and it'll make it very easy for our customers who are building digital experiences to bring that into the products that they are creating.
I'll come back to its interaction with APIs in a minute. But one of the challenges at the moment is AI is used in such a loose sense in so many ways. For many organizations, it's simply an extension of automation. The ability to take simplistic tasks, create automated routines that will take that mundane workload off of users. But we're moving very quickly onto a whole new world with agents and agentic AI, not least the semi-autonomous nature of agentic AI. That means we have to have a whole new set of thinking as to what we trust it to do, how we manage and how we look at it. What's your thinking within WSO2 as to how agentic AI will work in terms of developers and the developer experience?
That's a wonderful question. Right now, the way you talk to a lot of the generative AI and the agentic AI capabilities is through an API. Mm. If you look very naively, you would say, well, it's just an API call. I have everything I need. I know how to make an API call. Finish. I just embedded. But we see a few things that are very different in these new components in computing. As you mentioned, they're non-deterministic. So you call it twice with the same thing, it gives you a different answer. They are probabilistic in terms of their responses and how they're putting them together. there is a lot going on with their life cycle. They hallucinate. They may or may not be grounded in your own particular data that you can give them to help them be more accurate. And they have a different life cycle. So monitoring them, auditing them, and knowing what to do when something goes wrong is very different than dealing with deterministic traditional code bases, where if something goes wrong, there might be a bug, you can find a line of code to change, there can be a unit test, and you're done. In this case, it's very hard to reproduce the error, and there might have to be retraining or new guardrails put in place or something like that to fix the problem. It's not necessarily a change in one line of code any longer. And testing is now different. How do you do a regression? How do you make sure what you change, if it's fixed, the thing didn't break? All the other things. So we see a new set of tools and best practices emerging around being able to safely embed these things at scale. To do the simple proof of concept is quick. It's really when you, as you mentioned, once you have these up and running in production, you're relying on them to take actions, you're relying on them to do work. What does that mean? We are used to having bots. We know that there can be things that are transactional. So if you do a wire transfer, it might take money from one place, put it in another place, and you're confident of that. Let's say this is happening with a very clear audit trail. The processes around that have matured, and we are comfortable with that. With agents, what we're seeing is that they're new. Some people, taken to the extreme, the idea is this can be your new teammate. It has a role, has an identity, maybe has a performance review, who knows? I don't think we're at that level yet. That's the dream for an agent. Today, the simple way to think about them is they have an interface through some generative AI model so they can interact with humans. They can call what is called tools, which is the wrappers around APIs or capability that allows them to also talk to machines. They talk with humans, they interact with code. One thing they do that is different than just calling an API through a natural language interface is that they can decide what of their tools to use. You give them a task and they figure out, I have five tools, I'm going to call them in this or that order, I'm going to iterate a bunch of times, etc., etc. And then when I think I'm done, I'm going to return a response. That is the most basic thing. Now, the jury is also still out on exactly what is an agent. We used to know what agents were like 3-4 years ago. They had a very specific computer science definition. But now that they became hot again, everybody's jumping on the bandwagon and calling everything that touches generative AI an agent. It's kind of related to the original one. There's still some planning and reasoning and things going on, but it's now very ambiguous and nebulous. We can all agree that it uses some tools, it has some natural language interface, and it's doing some planning and reasoning so that its behavior is non-deterministic. There's a lot of discussion, some of it trending into the philosophical, so we don't need to go there. What I'm interested in is what can we do today that we could not do yesterday, and how do we enable that to give you value for things that can become better?
I'll come back to that value question in a minute. You talked there about deterministic versus non-deterministic. When we're coding something and we're testing, and I've been testing software since the 80s, we love deterministic because it's going to be repetitive. If it makes the mistake, it'll continue to make the mistake. I've also done technical support for 40 years, and if there's one thing that every technical support person hates, it's that intermittent bug. That's the non-deterministic problem we have here. When we're starting to talk about designing these systems, and you're talking to customers about these systems, and you're talking internally about how you use this, how are you separating the use in a deterministic versus non-deterministic way, and how do you establish quality and controls in both camps?
That's a really great question. Right now, these two spheres live a little bit separately, and they're handled separately. I believe that the future is a blend of the two, and that the tools will mature and evolve to allow for that. I believe that for the non-deterministic part first is knowing when you should do which one. There are cases when you can pay someone's paycheck and it changes its mind every time and it's in the ballpark. We don't like that. We like to know how much we're getting paid. But if I'm preparing for a panel tomorrow that I'm hosting and I want to brainstorm what questions I can ask or play out different scenarios to get my creative mind going, or I'm looking at creating different diagrams for a background or maybe generating voice with emotion out of my text, then I care a bit less. my worry about whether it's exactly the same or exactly accurate or backed by science or not is not there. It's knowing when to use the right tool for what scenario.
But how do we teach people when's the right tool? We know that when you give people an option, they'll take the path of least resistance. When you say to them, you've now got to choose which of these tools, people won't know how to choose. So we need guardrails on when you should be deterministic and non-deterministic.
That's a really good point. And before we get there, I didn't finish the answer to the previous one. Do we do something different? And you have to do something different. There's a whole area around eval. So instead of testing, they're calling it eval because you're looking at many things. Accuracy has been one for machine learning models. But now you look at other things in addition that go to the quality of the outcome of your application and what that behavior is. There's emerging ways of how to measure that, how to track it, and how to alert to be able to do something wrong. And there are several examples of this going on in the early days. We're still in the early days, but every time they find one of these problems, we patch it up a little bit. There's been quite a few examples of these natural language chatbots saying the wrong things or telling people to do bad things, of them being hacked. There's been examples of one that through some prompt hacking, someone convinced it to sell them a car for a dollar from a car dealership, right? There's been ways that people have been highlighting their weaknesses, and those are quickly getting patched. We need to learn and evolve and understand how can we deploy them first in places where if they misbehave, it's safe to do that. And how can we find ways where they are helping and providing value for humans, where it's an improvement of what was there before. If an experience can get better with the use of these technologies and it's safe to do so, let's go for it. That doesn't mean it's going to take over everything.
So on that non-deterministic side, I ask the question today, I get an answer. I ask the same question tomorrow, I get a different answer. Do we need a process by which I can then say to it, why are the answers different? Explain to me why this has changed. Because in a business sense, particularly if we're talking about teams making business decisions, I need to understand what has changed. I need to understand why your answer is different. Is it fact-based? Is it because you've seen something on Reddit? These are critical elements to making the right or wrong decision for business.
First, we have to remember that when we say the answer is different, it's not like today the answer is 5 and tomorrow the answer is 3. Mm-hmm. This is probabilistically stringing text together, mm-hmm. So it's maybe phrasing it differently, but you might still be getting a consistent answer. Mm-hmm. One thing people are starting to do now, depending on the scenario where this would make sense, is that you do several passes. You let it answer many, many times, and you let it judge and vote on them, and you take the most common one. You're trying to use the capabilities themselves to find consistency in the responses.
So it's like when IBM did the medical stuff with Watson, where it said it will come up with a set of probabilities of what the diagnosis could be, and then hand it to somebody else to make a human-in-the-loop decision.
In this first case, it's still the LLM that is judging and selecting based on consistency between many responses. However, back to your point about human in the loop, that becomes very, very important. If these things are recommending something that needs to be done in a situation where the side effects of that are of consequence, then you need accountability for that decision somehow. Ideally, right now, it is through a human in the loop who says, okay, this is what I'm going to do. You can vet what the answer is and agree or not. And they are accountable if that answer is wrong or something happens. There's a human that you can go to. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it becomes very, very difficult. You can't say, oh, the AI told me so.
Oh, I'm sure there will be people who would use that as their excuse.
Let's take a very simple example of code generation. There's a lot of code generation in AI, and there's a lot of debate that this is going to make people not understand what their code is doing, impossible to debug.
I fall into that category. I'm afraid once you start to take the actual coding away from people and say, here's an answer, there will be an inherent laziness. I'll just accept that for what it is.
What we see there is for people who are doing really well with those technologies, they're people who understand the technology deeply, they're generating the code. Maybe if they're just prototyping, they're just doing enough to try to get it going. But when they get to a point where they have to check the code into GitHub and move it to production, they are doing a thorough review of that code and checking it and understanding it. And they're not checking in because you check in with your name and your identity. So you're sensitive to the quality of what you are checking in, regardless of whether it came from code or from a Gen AI or not. Look, before people were copying from Stack Overflow all the time. You ask for a thing, you go find some code on Stack Overflow, you slap it in there, you hope for the best.
or you stole a piece of sample code Microsoft had written, or you look back through the old code libraries that we all used. That's, yeah. For large organizations or mid-sized organizations that have a life cycle process, the check-in, the verification, the testing, the approval, that should all be there. But we're in a world now where that group is increasingly small compared to the overall pool of developers. The ability for anybody now to get it to write a piece of code and then use that as a macro or use that in their daily work life, they're not going to check in. They're not going to verify. They're not going to test. Yet, what we're really talking about is a deterministic system where actually what it produces every time should be the same. We should be at least getting syntactically correct responses, even if it's not doing what the person thought, because what they described to it wasn't what it understood. So how do we tighten that?
That's a great point. There is work being done in the research community for folks working on generative AI and code. Not everyone is using only these big LLMs. They're trying to ground it in semantics and understanding of the code itself and marry it with other capabilities so that as much as possible the focus is on the problem, not the technology you use. My problem is I want to express my intent and as quickly as possible get to work in code that is secure, stable, scalable. The way to solve this problem is for us that are developing systems like that to think about that is the end goal that I want, and I will use whatever technology helps me get there, be it generative AI in whole or in part, and other capability. Because before we were creating stubs and skeletons and using wizards, we've been generating code for a long time. I agree it was deterministic, but you still can do so. The idea is to figure out how to blend these things together. The more generation you have with these models, then the more validation becomes important. If you can generate a lot of code, you're not sure how good it is. If you're very strong at either reviews or testing or data before you check in, then it's okay. You can be sloppy in the front and vice versa. If your validation is weak, your generation better be really, really solid, and then you have to be much more constrained in how your generation flow happens.
So there are multiple parts to this, and I'll come back to them bit by bit. Let's start with this prompt, the natural language question that I'm going to ask it to do. This is particularly relevant for yourselves because one of the storylines at the conference has been using AI to generate APIs. Those are going to get deeply embedded into systems. Yeah. So we need to have a real understanding of what it is we're asking it to generate and how. How do we begin to educate people on how to ask that question? You and I had a conversation yesterday about the challenge of natural language systems and ontologies, all the complexity that language brings with it. When we're saying to people, you're going to be able to define your API through natural language interface, I don't want to turn everybody into a prompt engineer. That's why I'm paying all these big bucks to data scientists. But how do we get to that point where what's being asked is what it's going to deliver?
That's a great point. And one thing we realize is often we see people that are very good at generating APIs, mm-hmm. often these prompts get in their way. Mm-hmm. If you know exactly what you want and how to word it, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But if you're a bit high level and there's a lot of ambiguity between what you stated and all the itty-bitty pieces that the system should know about the nuance of what's in your head and all the how to fill in the bits, then you have to keep refining and testing and going, and it's really more efficient then to just write the thing yourself. Yeah. People are figuring out what that balance looks like. Mm-hmm. That's why, for example, in Ballerina Integrator, we say that you can go from low code to pro code without a hiccup, because that gives you a no code editor. Mm-hmm. Then you can go into the Ballerina code if you want, and that's just code. What we like about that is it's saying whatever is good for you, whatever is going to get you your task done the best way, mm-hmm. is available to you. Some things are really awful in natural language. If you want to tell the computer enough so that it gives you something that works, you have to write a lot of text that's very detailed, and it's faster to write code. This is where we want to think about natural language as an enabler, mm-hmm. and not as the end goal.
This is very similar, as we said yesterday, to what Borland did with Calibre Define It, mm-hmm. where I would write my program requirements and it would generate me some outlier code, and then I'd do any refining inside that. So we're not doing something new, we're actually drawing on something that's been around for 20 plus years.
I don't think anything here is new. When ChatGPT came out, it was like the Netscape moment for these capabilities. The APIs had been around for a while, just only developers could use them. The rest of the world was unaware that the technology was there. But as with everything technology, you're building slowly over time, over many ideas that come and repeat and rehash. But something has changed. What changed with deep neural nets was compute became a lot more efficient. It became tractable. And the internet, suddenly a lot of data is digitized and accessible. Those two things made it possible to brute force your computational way through all that information and make it accessible to humans. But the idea of improving the software development lifecycle over time is not new. We've been wanting to have humans interact more naturally with machines since the dawn of computing. We touch it with the mouse, we talk to it with Siri. Those are old now, they seem boring. But when we first could tell, hey, what time is it? It felt dramatic, because that's speech to text, that's AI capability. People have been trying to do this over and over in bits and pieces for a very long time. I really think this is one more turn of that crank. If you think about, back to your point about the deterministic and not, Dijkstra has this wonderful paper, something like The Foolishness of Programming in Natural Language. Mm-hmm. And it's from the 80s or the 70s. As you're saying, the intention is not new, yeah. It's just more of the pieces are there now.
So let's assume we've written our prompt and our AI's generated me some code. Now I've got to test it. But I might not understand the language in which it's generated the code, because there's no reason now for me to actually have it generate in a language I know. I should be able to say to it, generate it in whatever language we've determined to be suitable for what we're going to deploy. Maybe because I'm a bit old, the idea of programmers testing their own code and marking their own homework has never gone down well. So the idea that the AI would write the code and would also write the tests, similarly, just doesn't sit well with me.
It's a different AI model writes the code and a different model grades it. Would you be okay with that?
That I don't have a problem with, because you've got a different view on it.
There's no conflict of interest.
Absolutely. So that's exactly what I was going to say. When you start to talk about this, do you see customers using multiple models to do some degree of cross-validation at a machine level?
That's really interesting. I've seen people use one model to generate and another to judge, but I don't know if it was, does it have to be one is OpenAI and one is DeepSeek? I don't really know. But you could. But this concept of using a judge model and a generator is something that is being experimented with. Mm-hmm. I did want to ask you one question back to what you were explaining, because you are finding it so difficult that I'm going to express in natural language and then it's going to generate, and that's, as a programmer, I'm losing control. But are you comfortable with compiled languages?
Gotta be careful here, because the question is, do you understand the compiler or don't you? I know where you're going here.
But you and I might, because we had it in our class so long ago, but yeah. The recent education and people who've been picking up compiled languages, I bet you most of them are not looking, and even if they're great developers, we don't question anymore, do they really understand the compiler, but will they trust the compiler?
But the real irony here is that we've moved away from compilers. Look at many of the new languages we've had. They're now all interpretive. They're not compiled. And it's taken that compiler question out the loop. But that's a question we'll never answer. Not unless you've written your own compiler will you ever be able to say, I understand the compile process.
But that's why we're putting one level of abstraction between us and assembly. Is it the right one? I still think natural language is too ambiguous.
Yes.
To be the right thing for everything. Yeah. But there are some things where the ambiguity doesn't matter, and maybe it helps because I need a creative answer, or I'm trying to do sentiment analysis, I'm trying to summarize and join text together, and then code isn't helping me. These natural language things are much better. Then I wanted to cycle back to what you were saying about guardrails and how do we manage these things. I think that becomes very, very important. There is work now just on request response mediation. There are libraries that are checking the training data. There are libraries that you can inject in the request response mediations to check for different bad behaviors or PII. That space is going to continue to evolve and become more important, as well as monitoring more quality of the application. I'm not sure how we're going to do that. Nobody really knows. Is it user satisfaction? What are you going to measure?
But this is not a new problem. It comes back to what you said earlier, and I said I've returned to, and that's the question of how do we know the value? We constantly talk about KPIs in how do we set a value, how do we get our return on investment. But in this instance, it's so new to us, we don't know what the KPI should be. We can't ask the machine, because the machine will just say, well, I'm your KPI. So how do we begin to create some form of business model that provides me with KPIs, provides me with an understanding of what my return on investment is of all this, but more importantly, can show to me, actually, this is the value it is bringing to your business.
So that's separate from how is it performing. Yes. It says, is it giving me value? And there are some things people are starting to measure. If you look at GitHub Copilot, if you have the enterprise version, it lets you measure how many of the suggestions it made did the developer accept and commit. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of a sniff test for are people finding it useful. Mm-hmm. People have been trying to measure, can I have less employees? Or I stay away from that. I'm not sure how those are measured or so on.
I think that's an absolutely wrong measure.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's where the value is. I've seen other work, for example, where they're using it to do patient follow-up, where doctors don't have time. This helps patients stay on track with their medication or make sure they can get to their appointments or something like this. Compare that to what happened before you had it. And then you can track more people to not miss their follow-ups. It's going to be dependent on the app. It's going to maybe rise up from the digital metric and more into the application domain and business metric. Which I think is closer to real value at the end of the day anyway.
Absolutely.
If anyone tells you they really know in this space, they're full of it. Right now, we're going through a massive shift in compute, like the early days of the web or the days of cloud, and there's a lot of unknown. But there are some patterns that we understand enough that we can use them today. Don't use it for your bank transaction or your pacemaker. Be aware of the ethical considerations and things like this, and start to explore, develop, build as much as you can to get used to it. That's the best advice. And use it in these low-risk situations. It's like with cloud. When first cloud came along, we were talking to some banks and they were saying, all my transactions are in the mainframe. I was like, you don't need to move your mainframe. Build a digital experience. Do a mobile app. Put the front end on the cloud. So you can still be part of this new technology and learn it and understand it. It has a chance to mature and evolve and build in checks and balances or decide it's only for those use cases. Mm-hmm. People want to be like all or nothing, and I really believe that's the wrong way to look at it.
Unfortunately, I know we're short on time because at the conference there's so many people want your time out there. So I'm going to ask you one last question. It ties back to how we started. We've heard about Bijara. We've heard about some of the enhancements within WSO2 API Manager, a little bit about Corio. But the company product portfolio is way bigger than that. What should customers be expecting as the first benefits from AI within the tools? When will they see a roadmap for all the tools they use now and when they will all become AI-enabled or even AI-native?
Yeah, that's a really wonderful question. This is by design. The AI pieces will come as part of the roadmap of the product. There is no separate AI thing. It's going to be part and parcel because we believe this is something that makes our products better. It will just be there with all the other things we need to be doing.
So it'll just sit in their current cycle of improvement?
Yes, it'll be part of new releases. There will be some AI things that make sense to release at that time because they're ready. We see a big wave that was announced just today across all our portfolio. Mm-hmm. And we see that in two views. One is make your software development life cycle better, faster, easier. These are the copilots and the assistants and the things in the console, the governance, natural language interfaces. Whatever you used to do now, you can do it more naturally, more natively, in safe ways, like you've been describing, and in ways that the human can check and validate the answer. On the other side, we also see that we have new capabilities to treat AI as building blocks for building your own AI native applications. And we see a few announcements like Ballerina Integrator now lets you, in your palette, you have generative AI models, you have knowledge bases, so you can build integrations that use generative AI and RAGs. You can also build an agent with it, also by drag and drop from the palette we make first class. So Ballerina Integrator, you deploy onto Bijira as an integration. Another area which is very interesting is identity and access management. That has been a thorn in the side of the agent community for the few days they've been around. But these agents are going to go do stuff. Guess what? They need delegated access, and it needs to be secured. If they're going to go on their own without being delegated from one user, we have someone has to think about what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Whose token are they going to use? All of that we're looking at in our identity and access management products, either the open source identity server or the SaaS version called AsGuardio. Mm-hmm. We also have in our API management something new that's been a few months now, but we keep evolving, which is the AI Gateway, which is just part of your API Gateway. Mm-hmm. And it's the capabilities that are focused on dealing with these generative AI models. And that area is growing quickly. So the kinds of things you would want to do there mm-hmm. are expanding and depending on what's happening. But that's where you could add guardrails, you could have compliance, you can govern all your interactions with any of these generative AI models based on your company policies. The nice thing is you can take all of these together, because I believe those are the pieces you would need to build your own AI native apps in production. It gives you a starter kit. But you can also take them one without the others. Mm-hmm. So if you're using your own agent framework and you want agent authentication, you can use WSO2 identity server for that. If you like to build and you want a gateway to your generative AI interactions and govern and monitor, you can use the AI gateway mm-hmm. for that. That is the beauty of the approach. We are thinking about it holistically, but we are enabling it as building blocks. So you can customize, you can take what you need. And it plugs naturally into the AI ecosystem. So we don't force you to use our agent framework, or you must use everything from us. We play well with all the model providers, all the models, the agent frameworks, the knowledge bases, etc.
Rania, thank you very much for talking with me. It sounds like it's going to be a really exciting ride.
Thank you so much, Ian. This has been really a great pleasure. Thank you.